MacCast, Monday, July 8th, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, summer is on. Yep, we've been talking about it. I hope you have been having a nice summer so far. Feels like it's going by way too fast, right? We're almost, well, we're into July at this point, but it's feeling like we're almost halfway through the summer, and pretty soon we're going to be turning around, and it's going to be the fall, and people are going to be going back to school, and all kinds of stuff is going to be happening. But in the meantime, hopefully you get a chance to take a vacation. I am actually prepping to head out of here pretty soon, and this will be an episode right before I take off. So getting ready to go, but wanted to get a MacCast out to you before I did that. Don't have a lot of stuff to cover this week, a few little items in the news, and then we're going to get back to some of your feedback and questions. I had a lot of follow-up to my conversation and comments about backup last time. So we've got a couple backup questions in this episode, following up on last episode, and then we're going to get into a thing of the moment that I think you're really going to like. Something that's kind of fun for the summer, maybe something you can pick up and do with your kids, technology related, of course, and there's some pretty neat stuff in it, so stay tuned for that. But that is going to round out this episode. Kicking things off, there was a feature that showed up this week in iOS 13 beta, the current beta of iOS, that is going to add a cool bit of new technology related to FaceTime. This was discovered by a couple people looking at the betas, and what they found out was that there is a new feature designed to address the issue of your eye line when you're making a FaceTime call, especially on an iPhone or an iPad, an iOS device. I guess this would factor in on Mac too, but right now this feature is exclusive to the iOS 13 beta. And the problem it addresses is the trouble that you have when you're looking at the image of the person that you're FaceTiming with on your device. The image you're looking at is there on the screen, and so when you're looking at the screen, you're technically not looking at the person you're having the conversation with. You're not making line-of-sight eye contact, and that's because in order to do that, in order to look at them, you would have to be looking directly at the FaceTime camera up in the true depth camera sensor area. So you'd be basically looking at the notch on your iPhone, and no one really does that, right? When you're having a FaceTime call, the person's face is in the middle of your phone, so you're looking at that. So your eyes are actually sort of looking down. And what Apple has done is they've added a new setting to FaceTime. They're calling FaceTime Attention Correction. And it is currently supported in the iOS 13 beta, but only on a couple of devices. At the moment, iPhone XS and XS Max exclusively, not even the iPhone XR. And the reason that it is implemented there is possibly because the feature uses ARKit 3 or the ARKit 3 API, which is currently limited to those devices. It's also in the iPhone XR, so supported by the iPhone XR, but this feature, this FaceTime attention correction feature, is not there. So there may be some other things related to the technology or the hardware, although the iPhone XR is pretty much on par with those other devices. So it could just be early beta stuff. I would expect that this feature rolls out or gets expanded to other devices, but it is believed that it is using ARKit and the TrueDepth camera system to adjust your eye position. So what several reviewers have noticed is that the way it appears to work is it kind of does a depth map of your face and then adjusts your eyes, and it is really good at doing it. I saw some videos, and there's some photos and demos online, and you really can't tell that there's anything going on. Now, several reviewers have noticed that you can see the effect if while it's enabled, you pass a horizontal straight object in front of your eyes. So people have used like a straw, or you could use a chopstick or anything that is straight. And what you'll notice, if you have the feature enabled, if you pass it over the front of your eyes, when that straight object gets there, it will be curved around your eyes. So it'll be slightly distorted, and that is the software actually correcting your eye line up to where it looks like you're looking at the EyeSight camera, even when you aren't. It's pretty trippy and kind of a cool technology. So it's a nice little enhancement, and I think it will be appreciated. People like it when you make eye contact with them when you're talking to them. If only they could do this for me in real life, then we would have a really cool tech. Huh? You know, maybe I guess when we're doing virtual reality stuff, it'll be sort of like that. I don't know. But anyway, cool technology nonetheless, and it's making its way into iOS 13. Again, I think other devices will be supported, hopefully. It's not just going to be exclusive to the newer devices, but it could be depending upon the tech that's going on under the hood. Looks like something that I thought never would happen might actually be happening, and I'm talking about the MacBook Pro butterfly keyboard design. We know that Apple has struggled with that a little bit. Several MacBook Pro owners have had issues with stuck keys and all kinds of things. Apple has gone through 4 revisions of their butterfly keyboard design, and it still doesn't feel like it's quite perfect. I kind of figured Apple would never give up on it, that they would keep working on it. But Ming-Chi Kuo this week says that Apple is again working on a new keyboard design, but this time they're going back to the old scissor mechanisms. He says that Apple will roll out the new design with an upcoming 2019 MacBook Air update. So we're still expected to get a MacBook Air update this year, and supposedly it's going to be using this new scissor switch design. The scissor switches are supposed to offer more durability, of course, longer key travel, which is something that a lot of people who rely on their keyboards heavily appreciate. And I think it will make many of the beleaguered butterfly switch keyboard users, people who don't like that design, feel much better. Ming-Chi Kuo also says that the MacBook Pros in 2020 should also pick up the new design. So it's looking like moving forward, this is what Apple is going to go with. And they're not just rolling back to the old design. It does actually seem like they're working on a new design here. It will supposedly feature glass fiber to reinforce the keys. So I'm assuming that will add more stability and stiffness. A couple of the features that Apple touted with the butterfly mechanism was that, you know, they were more stable across the key. So if you were pressing on an edge, it would still feel the same as if you were pressing right in the center. So it does sound like this new design is going to have some of the best of both worlds. Another advantage for Apple that Kuo notes is that the new keyboard design will be a little bit cheaper to manufacture. I guess the butterfly design was pretty expensive and resulted in lower yields, so that issue should be taken care of as well. And again, I think it's going to be a welcome return to a tried and true design, and many Mac fans and those of you in the market for future MacBook Pros are going to be, I think, pretty happy about that. And guess what? We are at the end of the news for this week. Well, I guess it's only been about 5 days since the last MacCast, but not a lot happening, I told you. But this story is somewhat interesting. If you're into foldable devices, there are rumors saying, although probably not very reliably, that Apple is exploring foldable iPads. And actually, I would be surprised if they weren't. I think Apple is exploring all kinds of different technology. I think foldable devices, foldable phones, foldable notebooks, foldable iPads are all things and technologies that Apple is looking heavily into and probably has been looking heavily into for years. But I certainly don't believe this latest report from IHS market analyst Jeff Lin. He says that Apple will have a foldable iPad in the market in 2020. He says that Apple is planning the device to compete with the new or rumored dual screen Surface expected from Microsoft. He also says that the new device will have 5G. I think that does seem plausible. I think Apple putting out a 5G iPad device in 2020 is likely a reality, especially now that they've sorted things out with Qualcomm and would have access to Qualcomm 5G technology and modems. But as far as a foldable iPad, I guess maybe a dual screen iPad with a hinge, that could be something Apple could be looking into and could throw together in 2020. But if we're talking about a device that's like the Samsung foldable phone that was a more or less disaster when it was given out early versions to reviewers, although I do know that Samsung, I think this week or this past week, supposedly has sorted out their issues with those devices. But I think that technology still in its infancy, I still think there's a lot of questions about durability long-term, especially in real-world environments. I know it's one thing to kind of test those things out in the lab, but once people get them in their hands, guess what? Humans have a way of abusing electronic devices, I think, in ways that manufacturers never think of. So, you know, I think it's a technology that will get here. I think it's a long way off from being consumer ready. And Apple, if nothing else, is usually about putting things into the market that are fully thought out and fully consumer ready. And I just don't see foldable displays or screens being that anytime in 2020. So again, Apple, They do a lot of research and development on things all the time. They think through ideas, they think through designs, and I'm sure they have all kinds of prototypes that they're working on. But a consumer level, you know, Apple selling it in 2020 device iPad, I'm not buying it. They did say the updated iPad would have new A series processors. Again, I think that's something that could be a reality. The other thing that brought into question this rumor was that they said the screen size would be similar in size to the screen sizes in the MacBook range. They didn't specify MacBook or MacBook Pro, MacBook Air. They didn't specify whether that meant folded up it would be that size or unfolded it would be that size. If it's unfolded at that size, that seems a bit odd because Apple actually sells an iPad at 12.9 inches, which is larger than the 12-inch MacBook screen. So we already have iPads at that screen size. So just another thing to kind of bring into question this rumor. But I don't know. What do you think? Could Apple put out a foldable device in 2020? Does that seem likely to you? Shoot me some emails. Send me some feedback. Maccast@gmail.com. But with that, like I said, that is going to do it for the news. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Capterra. Hey, you know, one of the best things about being on the internet is the ability when you need to find a product or find out about, say, a restaurant, a place you want to eat, or maybe a place you want to stay, is the ability to get reviews. We do it all the time, right? We would never, almost never in this day and age, go into a place without checking it out first, seeing what the Yelp review is, seeing what kind of ratings and reviews those places have from real people. And it helps us make really great decisions. What's odd is we would do that for all of those scenarios, but very often we don't do that when we're making buying choices for our business, especially about the software that we are going to use. Capterra, they solve that problem. They are the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solutions for your business. You can easily search more than 700 specific categories of software, from email marketing to project management. As an example of the kind of great software that you might find on Capterra, you know, they have Sanebox, which is a service that I have been using for years to automatically triage and pre-filter my inbox. It really helps keep my inbox under control, and I couldn't imagine living without it. And that's probably exactly why it has a 4.5-star rating with dozens of great comments and reviews over on Capterra. And it's really those comments where I think the real value is. They have over 750,000 of them, and the important thing is they're from real users of the software. So you can go there and discover everything you need to know to make an informed decision about the purchase that you're going to make. No matter what kind of software your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. You can join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Just visit capterra.com/maccast for free today to find the tools to make informed software decisions for your business. That's capterra.com/maccast, CAPTERRA.com/maccast, Capterra. Software selection simplified. And a big thank you to Capterra for their support of the MacCast. I think I told you last time on the MacCast that I am currently running on my backup setup of a 2011 MacBook Air. And actually, it's performing very, very well. But my tried and true 15-inch MacBook Pro was impacted and affected by Apple's battery recall. And so I've been kind of bummed that I haven't had that system around. It's been a little bit inconvenient. Of course, I have my backup, so I have access to all my files. That hasn't been a problem. Kind of restoring stuff is always a hassle, and I really don't like that. But I'll have to tell you, it does make me feel better this week. Because I saw some images that were posted from a designer in Florida of his 15-inch MacBook Pro that actually went through a catastrophic failure related to the battery. And it completely made me understand why Apple has issued this voluntary recall and why they're taking care of this. I will have a link to the images on a story picked up by Apple Insider over at maccast.com if you want to see them. But, you know, basically, this thing, he was sleeping, it was on a coffee table in the other room, and it exploded and caught fire. Luckily, it didn't set fire to anything around it. It looks like it did burn a slight hole in the coffee table, but it actually did burn a hole through the bottom of the MacBook Pro case. You know, that's aluminum. That's not something that is easily burned through. And just the chemicals and the chemistry, it makes you think, you know, if that was in your lap or something like that, how bad that would be. So it burned through the bottom of the case, burned a little bit in the coffee table. There was burn and scorch marks around the trackpad. It was not pretty. And to make matters worse, the guy who reported this said that the device was actually unplugged and in sleep mode. So it was just lid closed on the coffee table when this happened. It wasn't even charging. So this is kind of serious business, and I wanted to bring this up not just, you know, to make myself feel better because I don't have my MacBook Pro for 2 weeks. You know, that is a little odd. That is something I had not experienced before, is generally when I've had repairs done to my MacBook Pro, they'll say, you know, 1 to 2 weeks, something like that, and I'll often get it back quicker. That hasn't happened in this case. I have been without my MacBook Pro for over a week and a half now, rolling into 2 weeks, and I have not heard anything or gotten any status updates from Apple. They're going to be shipping it back to the Apple store, so hopefully they'll call me when it's ready to pick up. But something that was different this time, because I thought I would bring it in and maybe they would just swap the battery right there in the store, the genius actually told me, nope, we're having to send them back to the depot. And historically, if they're doing a battery thing, most of the time they would just swap the entire bottom casing. He said this time around, nope, they're actually going in and replacing the batteries. So I'm assuming that means scraping out the glue and dealing with that whole mess, which is, I'm assuming, why they're quoting such a long lead time. But just in case you have been, you hadn't heard about it, or if you've been waiting to take your 15-inch MacBook Pro into Apple, don't wait. Do it. Apple has recalled a select number of the devices. There is a page on their website where you can check your serial number. It is the mid-2015 15-inch MacBook Pro only. So if you don't have that model, you don't have to worry. Just in rare instances, they say the batteries can overheat and fail. And as you, if you go take a look at those pictures, as you'll see, it can be pretty catastrophic. So, you know, I would heed the warning there and get your machine in. And hopefully I'll have mine back in the next few days. On the last episode, we got into backup a little bit, and if you've listened to the MacCast for a while, you probably know that I am a huge fan of Time Machine. I often tell people, hey, if you're not going to do any other backup, if you only have one backup system, go out, get an external hard drive, get one that's about double the storage size of whatever your internal drive is in your Mac. So if you have a 512 gigabyte internal drive on your Mac, get a 1 terabyte, at least 1 terabyte external drive for your Time Machine. Plug that in. When it pops up and says, would you like to use this drive for a Time Machine? Say yes, and boom, you're done. You've got a backup. It really is that simple. And I think it's a great system. But I will admit, it isn't necessarily flawless. And occasionally, issues do come up with it. And I received this question and comment related to Time Machine and exactly that from listener Graham this week.
Hello, Adam. Listener Graham here. Just like you, I am a devoted student of multiple backups on all my computers. Now, recently, I had my MacBook Pro experience some corruption, and I decided to wipe the hard drive and restore it from a Time Machine backup. Now, before I began the whole process, I made sure that I had a total of 5 backups just so there'd be no problem. So I wiped the hard drive, and I started the process of doing a Time Machine restore of the entire system. Unfortunately, I received an error message back saying that the Time Machine backup had been corrupted, and it couldn't restore the entire disk to my computer. Now, luckily, I'd made multiple backups, and I had a carbon copy cloner backup that I was able to successfully restore. Unfortunately, this is the second time I've had a Time Machine backup fail on me when I was doing a full disk restore. As a result, I've really lost my faith in the reliability of Time Machine. I find that it works really well when I'm restoring an individual file, but it has very spotty results when you try to restore an entire disk. The most disturbing part of this whole process for me is that I don't know of any way to validate the integrity of a Time Machine backup. So before I did this process, I carefully checked my Time Machine backup, checked that the disk integrity was good, that all the files were doing okay, and then I erased. But unfortunately, it came back with this error. So I was hoping you might be able to give me some advice on ways that I could validate a Time Machine backup. Are there tools and ways that I can check to see if that disk backup is going to be reliable and it will work when I need to do a whole disk install? How can I avoid this problem in the future? Thanks again for your help. I've been a MacCast listener since the beginning, and I find your advice invaluable.
Hey, Graham, thank you for the question, and thank you for that very nice compliment. I don't know if I'm going to be able to help you out on this one, though, because, you know, like you, I'm not entirely sure if there is a way to really check the integrity of the Time Machine backups themselves. Of course, as you noted there, you can check the disk integrity, and that's something that I do recommend people do from time to time. You know, use your favorite disk checking tool, whether that be Disk Utility or something like Tech Tool Pro or one of the other great tools that are out there. We talked about some of those on the last episode of the MacCast, but beyond that, I'm not really sure that there is anything that you can do. Maybe someone in the audience or a listener might know, so they might be able to get back to us. I can tell you that you have made a great case for having multiple types of backups. You know, having a carbon copy cloner in addition to your Time Machine backup, in addition to maybe some archival backups with something like ChronoSync, which is something that I do for my really critical files, or having email backup with something like MailSteward, or especially having an offsite backup solution, Backblaze or one of the other great services out there. All of these things are really great, and as you note, come in handy when you run into problems with any single backup like Time Machine. I will tell you, it sounds like you've had a bit of bad luck with the full Time Machine restores. I don't generally do a lot of full restores from Time Machine. I like to use my clone backups for that, but I can tell you that I've done at least a couple in my life. I have done an erase and reinstall from scratch using a Time Machine backup, and I've been able to do 2 full restores without issue. So I think we might just chalk it up to the fact that, you know, hard drives, they can be finicky, they can be flaky, they can have issues or corruption, especially when you're moving around a lot of data. And that's the other thing about a Time Machine drive is I would say it probably gets a pretty good workout throughout the day, right? There's a lot of reading and write, or a lot of writing at least, going on as files change on your system and stuff like that, and it has to update. And if that Time Machine backup or Time Machine drive has been around for a long time, that can cause issues as well. I know another thing that often comes up for a lot of folks is just when Time Machine goes bad and it just notifies you. I have received a couple of those over the years where something has gone wrong with the Time Machine drive. You get that alert that says, hey, something's wrong. You need to start over with your Time Machine. And I know that gives a lot of people anxiety because they think, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose my backups. One, this is again another scenario where you might be glad that you have other forms of backup. But two, the other thing to remember, I think, is what a Time Machine backup is exactly. Time Machine is kind of its own, in my mind, a special form of backup because it is that thing that allows you to sort of go back in time, right? It keeps this history. And it's that history that a lot of people sort of lock onto, is that I know I have this ability to go back 6 months in time and grab a file that maybe I deleted or I forgot about or something happened with. The reality, though, I think, as most of us find out as we're using our machines and using Time Machine, is that we often don't do that. We don't delete a file and then suddenly realize we need it back. That's a rare instance. And so, you know, I think Time Machine, more often it goes that I accidentally deleted something right now. Oops, I want it back right now. It's not the scenario where I'm trying to go back and recover something from this sort of history. Sometimes that happens, but it's very, very rare. And so I don't think people should have a lot of anxiety about just rebuilding their Time Machine or starting from scratch, sort of erasing that history and starting over. I have done that several times with my Time Machine, and it's not been a real big problem for me. Again, I have a lot of other forms of backup, so maybe that's where that anxiety doesn't come into play. But that is a way to kind of refresh your Time Machine and maybe deal with possible corruption that might be in there. I do agree with you, Graham, that recovering individual files, that has always worked flawlessly. I'm going to knock on wood here, flawlessly for me in the past. I've been able to recover photos and email and all sorts of important files from time to time. But I have never really relied on Time Machine as the be-all, end-all backup. And I don't think most people should. Like I said, I think it is a great first backup solution. I think it is something that everybody should be using. It's not to knock on Time Machine, but I think it is part of an overall holistic backup strategy that everybody should have. So that's my two cents on it. Hopefully, if someone does know if there is a way to sort of, you know, check the health of your Time Machine backups, someone will let us know and send us some feedback to maccast@gmail.com. And if that does happen, Graham, of course, I will share that information on a future episode of the MacCast. But again, thank you for being a listener, and thank you for your great question. So while we're on this topic of backup, another thing I wanted to talk about is iCloud syncing and why iCloud and its various forms of syncing and storage, in my mind, are not backup, at least not for Macs, right? We do have iCloud backups of our iOS devices. Those are legitimate backups and can be considered backups. But I'm talking about on your Mac, you know, iCloud, at least for now, Apple does not offer a cloud backup service. That's not really what it's intended for. And this was illustrated for me this week in an email I received from Ron, because Ron was asking about Backblaze, something again that I brought up on the last episode of the MacCast. It is the online backup service that I use. I think it's great. I think it's got great pricing and great features. But Ron was asking, hey, what exactly gets backed up by Backblaze, because he had been a CrashPlan user. I had been a CrashPlan user for a long time until they got rid of their personal storage, which was when I switched to Backblaze. And Ron had decided, when sort of CrashPlan stopped offering their services, that he would just turn to iCloud and rely more and more on iCloud to sync up his data and store his files there, have a backup, you know, in the cloud with Apple. And again, I think it's important to note that word backup, it's not really a backup. You're storing your files in the cloud. I would say a lot of the iCloud features are much more similar to something like Dropbox, right? You put files on there, they sync to all your other Macs. Apple has, of course, some other features. You have photos in the cloud. You now have documents in the cloud. And again, these are all syncing technologies, not necessarily backup technologies. And so what had happened was Ron had noticed, he thought, well, I do need some sort of online backup system because I'm using iCloud, but that's not necessarily really backup. So he started using Backblaze on the trial. And I would encourage anybody to do this. I tried Backblaze out before I switched over to it, and they have a great trial offer. I think you get 7 days to just try out the service, see how things sync up, see how it works, and see if it's going to work for you. And so Ron was doing that, and what he noticed was that his iCloud files were not being backed up by Backblaze. And that got him wondering, you know, what's going on. He reached out to Backblaze customer service. Unfortunately, they gave him a really kind of pithy and not great answer, which is a bit unusual. I haven't found Backblaze support to be like that personally, but they did in this case. So, you know, maybe that's something they could work on. But it left Ron pretty confused. And Ron, I can totally understand why you would have been confused by their response, because they basically said, well, it's up to you. You know, if you want your stuff backed up, then you need to make that choice. And they didn't really answer his question. And so, Ron, I'm going to try my best to figure out what's going on here. I did email you back. I don't know if you missed that email. I haven't heard back from you yet. But one of the questions I had was, did you happen to know in your iCloud setup, if you're using documents in the cloud, did you have the option turned on for optimizing the storage on your Mac? It is one of the things in the settings. So if you go into your system preferences and you go into the iCloud settings and then you click on the documents in the cloud or iCloud Drive options, there is a checkbox down at the bottom that says optimize Mac storage. Double check if that is checked on or not. My suspicion is, because those files didn't back up to Backblaze, that checkbox is turned on. And the problem with that is that with that option enabled, what it tells Apple is, hey, if I am running out of storage on my local Mac and I have a bunch of documents that I've synced up from iCloud or synced up to iCloud, then go ahead, anything that's older, go ahead and remove that from my local Mac and just leave the copy that you have in iCloud. And if I ever need it back, I can just re-download it from iCloud, which sounds great, right? Because you get all this extra storage on your Mac. And if you have a bunch of old files, you can just have them living in iCloud and they can just stay there and you don't have to worry about them. Except here's where the problem comes into play. You do have to worry about them because, as you noted, if they're not on your local drive and you're using other forms of backup, say a cloned backup or Time Machine or Backblaze or any other online service, it's not going to be able to back up those files because guess what? They don't exist on your local Mac. They're only up in iCloud. And so at that point, Apple has your only copy of those documents. There is only one copy in one location, and as everybody knows, that's not backup, right? Those files are not backed up at all, unless you have another copy of them somewhere that you saved yourself in some sort of archive format. But if you're using a cloned backup, guess what? The next time your clone runs, if those files have been put up onto iCloud and then deleted locally, your clone is going to also not have those files. Eventually, services like Backblaze does kind of keep a history of deleted files, but I think it only runs for about 30 days, if I'm remembering right. Don't quote me on that, but there is a finite period of time. And same thing with Time Machine, right? There is a finite period of time once you've deleted a file to the point where that is removed from your Time Machine backups. So, yeah, I think that's what's going on, is you're probably not getting your files backed up because I'm guessing optimized storage on this Mac is enabled. And again, this is a feature. It's great. It is available on iCloud Photo Library as well, and is a great way to save storage on, say, iOS devices. I think it's a great option on an iOS device where maybe you don't want to eat up all that storage and have a copy of every document. But for this feature to work really well, I think what you need to do is decide to have one library or one location for all of your files and your storage that is kind of like the master location. And typically you would want to pick a Mac that is the location where you're going to do all your other forms of backup from, be it your clone backups, your time machines, and your cloud backups as well. So have one Mac and make sure that you never use the optimized storage on that Mac so that there is a copy of all your photo library, all your files, your documents, your desktop, everything lives on that one Mac. And then that way, when all those other backups run, it's going to back up all of those files. And, you know, iCloud, I think it's great for file syncing. It's great for storage and stuff, but it really just is not backup. And I think it's important to know that. Another little thing I think that often gets people confused with iCloud that I want to bring up in this conversation as well is iCloud Drive, right? You have that. It's like a network drive. You can put documents and files and stuff up there. You can have your iOS devices store in that iCloud location, and that is synced to all of your other devices. And iCloud Drive is a full syncing technology. And so with that, anything you do with the files in iCloud Drive on one device or one Mac automatically gets synced over to every other Mac and device that is sharing in that system. And so the problem becomes that sometimes people will think, well, you know, I can use iCloud Drive. I can take a file off my Mac. I can put it up into iCloud Drive and then delete it on my Mac, and then it'll be on iCloud Drive and every place else, and it can just live there. It doesn't work that way. It's a syncing technology. What you do on, again, this is important, what you do on one device or one computer happens on all other devices. So if you take that file, you let it go up into iCloud Drive, and then you delete it in iCloud Drive on your Mac, it's going to delete it in iCloud Drive in iCloud. It's going to delete it in iCloud Drive on your iPhone. It's going to delete it in iCloud Drive on your iPad. It does sync everywhere. So just be careful with that one as well. It's not a way to kind of save space on your Mac and have everything just live in cloud storage. So hopefully that clears things up, and hopefully, Ron, that helps explain maybe what's going on with Backblaze. If that's not the case, get back to me, let me know, and we'll look into it further. But I mean, Backblaze should be backing up everything that is on your Mac, with the exception of some system files, which it doesn't grab for obvious reasons. Your operating system, you could always reinstall, so it doesn't need to have all of those things up there stored in the cloud. But everything else, especially everything in your home folder, in your user account, that should be being backed up. And if you're not seeing that in the Optimize, iCloud storage option is not turned on. Again, let me know via email, maccast@gmail.com, and we'll do a little more. We'll do a little more digging. And thank you for your email. All right, I got one more thing for you in the episode for this week, and it is a really cool thing of the moment. It is the BBC Microbit. I actually got this a while ago. I've had it for a while, and it's a great little device if you're interested in playing around with hardware and coding. What it is it's from the BBC, yes, those folks over in the UK. It is a programmable board, kind of like a mini Arduino, and you can get this thing in a bundle for under about $20. And that includes like a battery pack and a USB cable to connect it up to your Mac, and the Microbit itself, which is a cool little computer, a little device. Of course, it has a processor and all that fun stuff, but it also has a 5x5 LED matrix, so you can actually write things out to a little LED screen right on the device. It has two buttons. It has an accelerometer. It has a temperature sensor. It has input-output pins that you can actually just attach alligator clips to. for hooking up to your electronics projects, and it has Bluetooth built in, which is key because that's what allows us to also use it with our iOS devices and our iPads and things like that. Our iPads, iPhones, I guess iOS devices, that covers all of them. But point is that you can take this thing and you can program it on your Mac. They have a web-based block editor that you can use through Microsoft. And also, you can just write Python code that you can run on it. And what's really cool is how you get your code onto the device. You basically just write it out through the software to a hex file, and then you just put that right onto the micro bit itself. And the way it works is you take the micro bit, you take the micro USB cable, connect that to your Mac via USB, and it just mounts like an external thumb drive. And then you just literally drag and drop your code right onto the device itself. Then it's programmed, and now whatever program you have runs on it, and you can create little games, you can have it do little messages, you can make a digital ID badge. There's just a ton of various uses for this, and it's just fun to play around with, especially great for getting kids interested in programming. To take it even further, you can also use it with an iOS app that you can download from the iOS store or from the App Store, and you can pair it via Bluetooth to your iPhone or your iPad and load and write programs that way as well. You can code, again, in a block editor. It has a simple drag and drop, block code editor, and you can do everything on it. You can access the accelerometer, you can access the Bluetooth, you can again access the LCD matrix and write things out to that. You can get at the accelerometer and the temperature sensors, do the input IO, all of that sort of stuff. Now, on the iOS app, you write your programs in JavaScript, and I don't know if it recompiles them back down into Python and then loads it on the device. I'm not exactly sure how that works, because you just literally hit download, and it uses Bluetooth to send your programs straight onto the device itself. So that works really well. And then what really got me back into the micro bit, because like I said, I'd had it for a while, was that I was poking around, because I've been wanting to learn Swift, the programming language for iOS that Apple developed. And Swift Playgrounds is a great thing for learning code and learning Swift on the iPad. So I was playing around in the Swift Playground app, and I noticed that there was a micro bit lesson, a micro bit playground. And I grabbed that, and I grabbed my micro bit, and you can actually learn to program Swift and do some very simple little code writing tutorials and interact with the micro bit right through Swift Playgrounds. And I think it's a great way to introduce someone to Swift. It's also a great way to see how hardware and software can interact through iOS via a Bluetooth controller. So you do need to get the latest Bluetooth controller from the MicroBit website to get this to work. But once you have that installed, you can just simply, through the Swift Playground, pair the playground to your MicroBit and then run through the little coding lessons. And it's really cool because you get to program in Swift, and then there's a virtual version on screen where you can kind of see how it's going to interact, but then you can hit run code and it actually runs the code right on the micro bit device itself. So pretty cool. I think it's a great thing, and again, it's under $20. I think in the UK it's like £13 or something like that. You can check it out at microbit.org, and it is the BBC Microbit, and it is my thing of the moment for this week. But with that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Leave voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Hope you're having a great summer, and I will talk to you all again real soon.